Hey, this is Nick Gillespie with Reason. Before we get to today's podcast, I wanted to make sure that you knew that we are in the middle of our annual Webathon. It's a week-long event where we ask our listeners and our readers and our viewers to help us out with fully tax-deductible charitable donations. We got started in 1968 as a mimeograph magazine. We're now the world's largest source of news, culture, politics, and ideas from a principled libertarian point of view. Your support is what makes all of this happen. So if you dig Reason and you want more of it in the world, please go to Reason.com and think about donating to our Webathon today.
President Trump tonight honoring the memory of George H.W. Bush.
We'll be spending 3 days of mourning and 3 days of celebrating a really great man's life. So we look forward to doing that, and he certainly deserves it.
That was President Donald Trump talking about the week of mourning Washington will be having for his predecessor, George H.W. Bush, who died Friday at age 94. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Reason Podcast, Editor's Roundtable Edition. I am Matt Welch, joined by my colleagues Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Hello, super friends.
Hello.
Hello.
Very much looking forward to this.
Wow.
This low energy, Peter. This podcast, unlike all three major cable news networks, will not be entirely devoted towards memorials for George H.W. Bush. But I did want to get some reactions about pieces of 41's legacy, particularly from the two of you who have not already weighed in extensively on the website, as Nick and I have. So, Suderman, just starting with you, what's something that stands out to you about our last World War II veteran president?
So George H.W. Bush's presidency was a pivotal moment in the modern history of tax and budget deals. He ran on a no new taxes promise, which he then broke by signing a deal with the Democratic Congress that was at the time billed as $1 of tax hikes for every $2 of spending cuts that got put in place. Now, to understand this deal, you need to know just a little bit about budget history prior to that, which is that during the 1980s...
I want some budget history to start out the pod.
It's great. This is how we're going to start this morning.
Do it.
Because George H.W. Bush's presidency... was a big moment, and it has really significant kind of echo effects today. H.W. came in after the failure of what was called Graham-Rudman-Hollings, which was the original sequestration plan, which was basically during the 1980s under Ronald Reagan, after the tax hikes and the defense spending buildup, after the tax cuts and the defense spending buildup, the deficit was at its post-war peak. And so Congress was like, we should do something about this. So they put in an automatic spending cut system called Graham-Rudman-Hollings, named after the three legislators who were sort of principally responsible for it. Basically said that unless certain deficit reduction targets were hit, automatic spending cuts would go into place. Well, this just failed. It just didn't work. The spending cuts, they didn't hit the deficit reduction targets. I think they might have hit them once, an interim target, but they basically didn't hit the deficit reduction targets. And then also the sequestration didn't stick either. So as a result, HW was in a position where they were trying to reduce the deficit again. And so he agreed to break his campaign promise of no new taxes, read my lips, probably the most famous campaign promise in modern American political history, broke it. The tax hikes went into effect. And then the argument has been ever since on the right that the spending cuts did not go into effect. And so as a result of that, deal, Republicans have basically taken two messages to heart and have had a huge effect on the party and formed sort of the core of the party's domestic policy stance, which is we don't raise taxes and we don't do budget deals to raise taxes, even if they include spending cuts, because the spending cuts are always scheduled for later and they don't go into effect. And now if you go back and actually look at the spending cuts, it's a little bit more complicated than that. the actual real dollar spending did go up, and it went up more than it was supposed to under this deal. If you look at the CBO reports for the first 5 years of the 1990s. However, spending as a percentage of GDP did go down, and defense spending went down. So, you know, I think there's sort of a, you can make a case for this deal. It paved the way for the basically non-existent budget deficits for the, you know, of the Clinton years, for the relatively small as a percentage of GDP government spending of the Clinton years. It kind of set that up. And the way it did it was through a combination of tax hikes and hopeful spending cuts. On the other hand, it totally didn't live up to its actual promises. And I think there were real political ramifications for HW for raising taxes after he promised not to.
Oh, quick follow up, Peter. I was listening to my local WNYC communist radio station here, and I think I heard someone say that at the time of that deal, maybe it was MSNBC, at the time of that deal, the budget deficit was a completely untenable $150 billion a year.
Yeah, I mean, the ridiculous budget deficits were much smaller back then. And the assumption was that those deficits were just were not sustainable, were going to be a huge problem. But look, throughout the 1990s, under Clinton, the budget deficit did come down. Now, you can make there's arguments about whether at the end of Clinton's presidency, the budget deficit, there was actually a surplus or not, depending on exactly how you do the math. But there's no question that it came down, and that government spending as a percentage of the total economy was the smallest of my lifetime. Again, I was born in 1981. And so, you know, I think there are two legitimate ways to look at this. On the one hand, those spending cuts, the domestic discretionary spending cuts, the spending cuts to entitlement programs, they didn't happen. Those programs didn't get any smaller, and folks are right to point that out. On the other hand, this deal did pave the way for the most, this is a relative judgment, but the most limited government, period of limited government that I think I have ever seen.
Nick, just to follow up on that, and I wasn't intending to ask you that question, but what the hell, is part of that story the kind of HW and Bill Clinton story, early 1990s, just that we had a temporary peace dividend that we decided to screw it, let's go back to business as usual within 3 or 4 years?
Well, you know, 9/11 happened, which it really was the predicate for massive jacking up of defense spending in the 21st century. But to give Bush credit, I think, you know, the one real legacy that I think is a good one is he immediately started cutting defense spending, essentially, when the Cold War ended, when it was clear that the Soviet Union, you know, was on its way out, and Clinton continued that drawdown as well. So the peace dividend was real, and you know, it went back to, I guess you can say on some level, it went back to taxpayers, in the sense that we didn't spend as much year over year on defense.
And we also,
yeah, if you look at the numbers between, again, in the 5 years after the budget deal, like I said, total government spending went up, but defense spending went down, and yep. So that's where to the extent that there were spending cuts, that's where it happened. But that is yet another reason why conservatives remain and Republicans remain quite wary of these budget deals, is because Republicans typically want to see defense spending increases, even in sort of the post-Cold War type situation. And so they will argue, well, the only spending cuts we ever got were to defense, then the rest of the spending cuts were totally fake, and we accepted tax hikes in exchange for defense spending cuts? That's crazy. Yeah.
Throughout the 90s, Newt Gingrich, who was Speaker of the House, you know, oversaw, you know, reductions in defense spending while complaining about them. But he went along with it as well, because it's the one, you know, it's one part of the budget, I guess, that you could actually cut.
Yeah, I mean, that mirrors, Nick, the sequestration. And that's an E on the sequestration, Peter, not the
sequestration.
Sequestration, like seasteading,
like Sequest DSV.
It echoes the brief moments of fiscal sanity that was brought to us by the Tea Party generation of Republicans, the Rand Pauls and such, with the sequestration deal. They did get year on year flattening, even slightly reductions in military spending. I think actually it's defense budget spending more than actual military spending because of the emergency supplementals and the war spending and such like. But it also, in those things, as you mentioned, they complain about it throughout, which paves the way for it to be undone. Because as soon as there is a politics available for, like, we have to reverse these historically horrific cut to the bone military cuts, it's all over. And the Republicans who ran for the class of 2014, quite unlike the class of 2010. 2010, the class was Rand Paul and Mike Lee. 2014, it was the class of Tom Cotton. Those people ran on, like, we have to undo these devastating cuts. And as soon as the Senate, as soon as there was full Republican control, as opposed to minority Republican control, they had already paved the way for undoing the one thing that was good. Catherine, what is the thing about George H.W. Bush's presidency, a moment that is of particular interest to you?
So I went back to visit what is clearly the real pivotal moment of George H.W.'s presidency, which was the grocery scanner incident. I actually, so this is 1992 when this happened. I was 12, and I didn't even fully remember what this was. I knew that I had a vague idea that George H.W. Bush was an out-of-touch patrician who didn't know how much groceries cost or something. And I actually, it took me a couple tries on search terms even to get, oh, right, right. It was that he was amazed by a grocery scanner. And this was taken as evidence in the New York Times in February of 1992 that he was, you know, he hadn't done his own shopping in years. And it just showed how, you know, this man had, you know, no sense of what the real people of America
he was
were.
A son of wealth and privilege,
son of who had wealth
been
and privilege
insulated by his position of power.
Yes. And there was a whole line in this New York Times piece, which was the sole source of this thing, right? Like, this is something that I hadn't realized. It was just one bitchy New York Times piece that got the story wrong and set really probably one of the two things people know about George H.W. Bush besides the war. In fact, this I urge everyone to go read the Snopes treatment of this incident because it is truly Snopes at its best. And it starts with Paul Revere's engraving of the Boston Massacre.
What?
And just goes from there as this, like, incredible treatment of how when a single image or anecdote fits into pre-existing frameworks, that image or anecdote can become super powerful, even if it's not true. In fact, the New York Times reporter who did that 1992 story wasn't even at the grocery store at the time. This was a sample grocery store of the future. Bush casually mentioned that he had been amazed by some of the technology he saw inside. In fact, there was futuristic technology inside, including barcode scanners that could read torn labels and also could weigh wall scanning. And, you know, what's more, there was video that was available, and everyone else who viewed the video, even contemporaneously, was like, yeah, he actually seems a little bored because grocery stores are boring. He was being polite.
And the other part of this is that he was using the technology himself, right? It wasn't just that he was watching it being done and being like, wow, they scan groceries right now. It was, we've put a high-tech scanner in your hand, and he's being a polite politician.
And he goes,
who's like saying,
that's amazing. That's
this
great.
This is kind of neat.
Hey, yeah. Hey, Nick, just a fact check of my own memory here. Wasn't there another mm-hmm. politician, or maybe it was him too, around the same time, who got beat up for not knowing the price of a gallon of milk? I seem to recall.
So there was milk in this story, okay. But Margaret Thatcher also got in trouble for not knowing the price of butter. So there's that as well.
I just
the large story too of the 92 campaign was that Bill Clinton felt your pain, whereas George Bush was just kind of out of it.
He definitely read a memo about your pain.
Yeah, or he had people looking into that who would get back to him at some point.
And Bill Clinton could play the saxophone too, which.
There was so much economic anxiety. There was a recession in 91, which the Clinton-Gore campaign talked about as the worst recession since the Great Depression. And anything that made Bush kind of look out of touch and tired, because
you know, relative to Clinton. I mean, there was a whole generational shift going on. It really did play into the, you know, into a kind of existing narrative, which also was that Bush was kind of out of, you know, he claimed to be out of the loop during Iran-Contra. And you can just see a ton of things. There was that debate, the three-way debate with Ross Perot, where he was caught looking at his watch as if he had somewhere else to go. And it probably, that
but
Skinner
don't
story.
Don't you feel like that watch thing
gigantic.
Was another example of sort of people being,
yeah.
Absolutely. He's on a debate stage. He was checking his time.
Yeah.
Like it's,
yeah.
I don't know. I want to say, like, I am not a huge George H.W. fan necessarily. I think, like, the death of the patrician politician, well, now the literal death, but I meant the metaphorical death when he was defeated in his reelection campaign was probably a good thing for American politics.
I know
by
you have
and large.
A secret Twitter account.
But
that's like HW fan since 80.
Yeah. I have a tank top that's just, you know, but
it's just a picture of his face.
Yeah. But at the same time, I do think, you know, this is such a great example. And really, I mean, you might be able to trace at least some of the media has it out for Republican presidents thing, which is now basically the primary conversation we are having about politics, I think, to this incident or
that was
Bush's
fake news.
And
you know
Bush's
who the reporter
campaign.
Was.
Andy
Rosenthal, who then went on to become the editor of the New York Times op-ed page for like 25 years or something, who was
which
one
is
of the
right?
most
like,
important shapers of political opinion in the nation for several decades.
And again, let's just remember, from the journalistic ethics perspective, what he did here was write a color-driven piece about an event that he was not present for. And then the New York Times never retracted or amended this piece in any way.
I just want to point out that if I had a also not their reporter or even a their reporter following my consumer transactions, they could have found as recently as yesterday at a McDonald's in Brooklyn that I have no idea. Zero. Like I've got like 9-year-olds like they can deal with that little automatic thing. I have no idea how to find the French fries on the McDonald's scanner. I'm like, I'm pressing buttons for help. I'm like cursing loudly. It's taking 5 minutes. This was true even back then.
You just hit it really hard, like you're, it's pretend that you're, it's your keyboard on your computer.
Even back then, and I was a hater of George H.W. Bush when he was running for president. Certainly, back then, as a snot-nosed college student. But even then, in 92, when they were talking about, like, oh, he doesn't know, or anyone doesn't know the price of milk, I'm like, to this day, I have no idea the consumer prices of everything, and I shop for it constantly. I don't want to know the price. I want to have the feeling that I don't know the price and don't care about the price, because then I won't feel poor anymore.
Can I just say, I was not president. I was not present. I was neither president nor present at any of the stories you just told, but I could write a fully accurate color driven piece about those things.
Well, it would not be fake news.
With the Bush scanner thing, wasn't it that the White House had a pool of reporters who would file like generic stories?
Yeah, he wrote it from a pool report.
It was kosher for people to, you know, kind of build off of that.
Except that none of the reporters who were there, no other reporter thought that Bush's reaction was notable enough to include.
Right.
And you don't gauge emotional state of a human off of a pool report. You get the facts and the figures.
And when people went back and re-reported, lightly I would say, but when there was some re-reporting of this incident, much less heavy than I think you would see now today if this sort of thing were happen and
this would be like a 4-day news cycle.
Oh yeah, there would be 1,000 tweets. When people went back and reported, basically every other paper and every other reporter, every other person who was witness to that event was like, this was not a big deal. Rosenthal completely got this wrong.
I don't know whose Twitter feed I found this from this morning, but someone was hashing the 1992 kind of press corp heavy pivot away and against H.W. Bush, scanners part of it. Apparently, Sidney Blumenthal, and this will come as a surprise to nobody who's ever even familiarized themselves with the name of that particularly nasty character, wrote a piece in the fall of 92 for New Republic talking about how, you know, Bush's whole war hero thing, totally like over-exaggerated. So he's like swift boating a World War II vet at the time. So it does kind of build this up. Nick, is there's a weird sense of irony, right? Because we are all four of us in the same room together somehow on Wednesday during our special webathon podcast edition, and we were talking about kind of libertarian origin stories, and part of yours was about the hysterical anti-George H.W. Bush reaction by college students and other people that you observed on campus, which Jesse wrote basically about the same thing there too. And I'm just kind of wondering, you wrote a broader piece about Bush saying didn't leave a whole lot for libertarians to cheer about. So do you feel like that it's the sort of a case where every president is terrible? Or is there something kind of unique about what Bush left us with that's haunting us to this day?
Well, I think that there's a strong case that our, you know, the invasion of Kuwait and then the hemming in of Iraq afterwards, which at the time was seen as, I was against it. This was before I was a political journalist, but I didn't think it was our fight. And I still think that's true. And there's, you know, the intelligence that was used to claim that Iraq was actually threatening not just Kuwait, but also Saudi Arabia. There was a ton of intelligence that was just turned out to be completely fabricated or faked. It was also clear that George Bush had given the U.S. ambassador to Iraq had talked with Saddam Hussein just a week before he invaded Kuwait, and basically gave what is clearly a code of saying, like, we don't give a shit if you invade Kuwait. And then the way that the peace was handled and hemming in Saddam Hussein, it doesn't give rise to 9/11 in the sense that, you know, 9/11 was not about Iraq or anything, but it did destabilize. It created a real problem in the Middle East that ended up, you know, coming back when we invaded Iraq and everything kind of went to shit. So, you know, there's that. I mean, it's a huge, legacy and a negative one. And I think Bush deserve credit for actually putting together a coalition of the willing and getting all of the countries that were adjacent to Iraq and Kuwait on board, limiting the mission so it wasn't regime change, but in the end put into motion, you know, a process of destabilization that we're still dealing with, as a country.
Just building on that, I think would like to propose at least that there is something close to an iron rule of U.S. Interventionism abroad, which is that whatever principle that you are upholding, that you feel, or the participants feel that they are upholding in the way that it is sold, will end up being degraded by the very act of trying to uphold it. And I think in this case, the principle that's out there is the notion of sovereignty. September 10th, 1990, there was a joint press conference. Imagine this, the President of the United States and Secretary General, whatever they called him, of Russia, Mikhail Gorbachev, Bush and Gorbachev, press conference 1990. They say in a joint statement together, these Cold War adversaries, we are united in the belief that Iraq's aggression must not be tolerated. Money quote, no peaceful international order is possible if larger states can devour their smaller neighbors. They were talking about sovereignty of smaller nations being swallowed up, and they aimed. And the very next day, Bush gave a speech to a joint session of Congress introducing the marvelous phrase, or actually codifying a phrase that had been in conspiracy theory circles for a long time, New World Order. I really thought that this is what we're going to do. And I'll quote from it. Out of these troubled times, our fifth objective of whatever his four previous objectives of this intervention was, a new world order can emerge, a new era freer from the threat of terror, stronger in the pursuit of justice, and more secure in the quest for peace, an era in which the nations of the world, East and West, North and South, can prosper and live in harmony, an era, a world where the rule of law supplants the rule of the jungle, a world in which nations recognize the shared responsibility for freedom and justice, where the strong respect the rights of the weak. I would like to point out that all sounds pretty good. In terms of like goals, especially for me, the respect of smaller nation sovereignty something that that hits very close to home for me. But then what happened? The way to protect the sovereignty was, as Nick rightly pointed out, a limited thing. Repel the invasion. Get out. Iraq, get out of Kuwait. Right. But that's not where the story ends at all, because as part of that, too, then the U.S. eventually gets into, first of all, Bush says to a lot of Iraqis out there, including the Kurds and others, like, once you go ahead and rebel against Saddam Hussein, we totally got your back. Well, we didn't have their back, and that was all a disaster. And then secondly, that notion itself is a violation of sovereignty of an admittedly evil dictator, terrible person. The U.S. then sets up no-fly zones, totally violating the sovereignty of Iraq, and sets itself up as the world's selective enforcer of weapons of mass destruction development, which then leads to a 9/11 era. And so we're at a place now in 2016, 17, and 18, where when Russia goes into and takes Crimea and kind of fights in half of Ukraine, people are like, I don't know, man, that sucks, I guess. That is such a different place than it was back then. But part of what set that all in motion was the initial idea to do it in the name of sovereignty. You see similar kind of inversions of things, like when Barack Obama got into or sold the idea of Hillary Clinton's war in Libya. We're going to do this to protect the citizens of Benghazi from an imminent possible slaughter. We've just seen so much more slaughter in the subsequent events from that. It should give us all pause whenever we feel like we want to hit the red button and have America come to the rescue on issue X. That is a good sign that, we're about to get into a bad place on issue X. Let's pivot after I've X'd that conversation out to a absolutely impressive or at least voluminous amount of news related to the Mueller investigation that came out last week, particularly the tail end of the week, some of which broke while I was on live television, which is super fun to be a part of. The biggest individual piece was former Trump lawyer fixer Stephen Cohen making a surprise plea on
Michael
Cohen. Stephen Cohen. Who's Stephen Cohen? He's the apologist for Gorbachev, damn it. Michael Cohen. Thank you, Nick.
Let's get out of the 1990s, Matt.
Never.
Or not.
Never, never, never. Anyways, he pled in court in New York for the first time to the Mueller investigation and not a subsidiary investigation having to do with Stormy Daniels. And he pled out of lying to Congress when he had testified that the Trump Organization had stopped trying to get a Trump Tower Moscow deal done as of January 2016, which is right before the Iowa caucuses. And that was the end of all that. In fact, he testified in open court. The negotiations continued not just throughout 2016, but also 2017 as well, and included direct back and forth contacts with Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov. There's been subsequent reporting about from BuzzFeed, who's led on this story, about a possible secret $50 million penthouse in the proposed Trump Tower that would be for Vladimir Putin. There are tons of other legal dumps as part of this involving the likes of Roger Stone and Jerome Corsi. But I wanted to just kind of clear all that aside for the moment and get to a singular question here, which I'll throw to Catherine first. How much does it matter to you, or should it matter to all of us, that a presidential candidate apparently lied, misled heavily about his own business transactions with a dodgy foreign character throughout 2016 and 2017?
So this is one reason I've struggled with the way that this whole story in all of its manifestations has consumed the news cycle, is I really don't know how to usefully answer that question. So I can answer it in the full libertarian mode, right? Just like, never go full libertarian, but let's do it, which is
always go full libertarian,
which is
you're on the
to say, this is what happens when you entangle commerce and the state, right? Like, and I think at the very base level, that is my takeaway from this. It's like, if you are doing business deals that are so closely entangled with people who are also running governments, this is inevitable. There is no way around this. And whether it happens in this particular case to violate campaign finance laws or other laws is much less relevant to me than the fact that this is normal. It's just normally done in a better lawyered, more orderly way where people take breaks at the appropriate moment of doing this thing that they're always doing in the background anyway. On the other hand, you know, I think at the beginning of this investigation, it looked, to borrow a phrase, witch huntier than it turned out to be. Like, there really are real connections here. I think we you know, there's now enough public information to say there are real connections between Trump's campaign and very powerful people in the Russian government. And that is something that people, including Cohen, explicitly denied and are now that's being shown to be untrue. So, you know, I think it's not great to have that entanglement. Do I think U.S. policy in important fundamental ways is being reshaped by Trump's desire to have a fancy hotel in Moscow? No, I basically don't. I think there's like petty graft. I think there's favor trading. I think there's very, very small decisions made on the margins about, you know, tone and how we deal with Russia. But I don't fundamentally think things that would never happen otherwise are happening because of private business deals. At the same time, I wish that we lived in a world where private business deals and the government had nothing to do with each other. And that's not an insane proposition. Like, there, such a world could and should exist.
Peter, what about the lying, man? Isn't lying important?
The lying is bad. Lying is not good. The lying and the entanglement and the, in particular, the fact that Trump didn't just say, I have nothing to do with Russia, which he said, I have nothing to do with Russia for anything. That's July of 2016. And then you go to January of, I believe, 2017. And he said, we could make deals in Russia very easily if we wanted to. I just don't want to because I think that would be a conflict. Trump is saying that he understands. He understood that having those business deals would be a serious conflict of interest. Cohen is basically saying that he lied to cover up a conflict for the person who is now the president. And I think that should worry us quite a bit.
Nick, we had shared on our Slack channel, and this really should just be the discussion of Reason's interior Slack channels, most of them, but not all of them. New York Times had an interactive thing about everybody who's been charged in the Mueller campaign. Here's a list. Here's the charges. Here's the status. And you pointed out after I threw that up there, like everyone who has been in America, who has been like pled out or convicted or whatever, it's all essentially lying to investigators or lying to Congress charges. Given that observation, which is accurate at this moment, but also given the kind of import of what Peters and Catherine have said, how does this put you, where does this put you on your ideas about the investigation itself, whether it has gone too far afield, whether it's using, a bazooka to kill a gnat?
Yeah. This goes to kind of the Manafort stuff as well, where he's getting dinged for stuff that is uncovered because he was Trump's campaign manager, but it doesn't actually have to do with Trump or even with Russia per se and kind of collusion. I'm still skeptical of Cohen, and I don't know exactly, what he said, what he contradicts, and then who is going to come forward with a different version of things. But I'm, at this point, I think that we're still fixated on Russia for reasons that exceed, I think it's kind of a hysteria that is being pushed by a variety of media and political interests to say everything about Russia. First off, Russia is much more entangled in American elections. Russia is much more powerful than it is on the world stage and things like that. So at this point, until Mueller comes out with whatever he's going to be making in his final report, I don't think that we have enough information to really kind of talk about stuff.
So I don't know if you read Ken White's piece in The Atlantic about this, but one of the points that Ken White makes is that now that Whitaker is in charge at DOJ, it's at least imaginable that Whitaker, who has said that the Russia investigation has gone too far and should probably be sort of taken to an end, and appears to have been installed largely because of his opinions about the Russia investigation, that the report will end up being suppressed somehow. And that, and so what Ken White, who has written for Reason, in fact written for Reason about Michael Cohen and about some of these related issues, what Ken White said is that it is quite possible that what Mueller is doing is basically issuing his report in the form of court documents, and that these the charges and that the public court documents that cannot be suppressed are giving us hints about things. And there's a couple of things, you know, sort of worth pointing out there. One is Mueller in the court documents related to Cohen makes a somewhat oddly specific reference. And this was written up by Axios, so it sort of pulled it out, all of this for us, to Russian hackers targeting Clinton for the first time following Trump's, "Hey, Russia, if you're listening, I'd love to see the 30,000 emails." So Trump makes those statements. And then it looks like the hackers went after Clinton the following day. And so that's in Mueller's report in some court documents that Mueller has filed. And that's sort of telling. Mueller is suggesting what he knows, and suggesting that there, you know, I mean, that seems like a strong hint that he thinks that there's something there.
Here's a question related to that. And I'll actually throw it to Catherine, even though Nick would be the obvious foil for it. Let's imagine for a second that there is connective tissue on some level. And if I'm a betting person, I would say that there eventually will be some. This has to do with Roger Stone and perhaps even Joram Corsi and WikiLeaks and all this kind of stuff. It is a crime, I think. Not that Mueller is going to ever charge anyone or charge the president with this crime. But it is a crime, as far as I understand, to collude with even by the transitive property with a hostile or even anybody foreign person who illegally gets a cache of emails, and then you collude with them in terms of coordinating a distribution. This would be, if there's ever a collusion charge, as it has been explained to me by people who are smarter, it would look something like that. So let's imagine all that is true, Catherine. Should it be illegal for a campaign to coordinate with a foreign power to unearth a bunch of emails that are true emails? Is that something that should be illegal?
So this is, to me, this feels exactly like the question, should insider trading be illegal? Like, it's actually an efficiency maximizing thing, which makes me want it to be legal, right? Like, if, as you say, there's true information and it is material and relevant to U.S. elections, the road that it gets into the public eye happening to involve a foreign agent and also an American who is running for office or holding office doesn't seem super morally relevant to me. At the same time, I think that rules prohibiting that sort of interaction can be speech restricting and you know, fundamentally unconstitutional when it's a slightly different slice of this problem. So, right, so if you imagine, first of all, basically anything WikiLeaks does, right, like that's you know, that often runs exactly in the same turf. You don't know who is involved in the chain of custody of this information before it comes out. And it shouldn't be that if the whole chain of custody is private individuals that all happen to live in the United States, it's fine. And if for some reason someone is a citizen or official in a foreign country and someone is an official or a candidate in our country, that suddenly everyone's rights are different. That doesn't strike me as the right way to be. At the same time, I recognize that basically everyone in America disagrees with me. Like, most people think that it is an most people think that it is an uncontroversial statement to say, like, Ruski spies shouldn't be allowed to mess with our shit. And I think that's worth taking into consideration. And it's, you know, I think there's the second order question here, which is like, if everyone involved knows that this was illegal, which they clearly do because they go to great lengths to to lie about it and to hide it and to kind of attempt to walk the fine line of legality by, for instance, in theory, not communicating with the principal about an investment because he's running for office. You know, in that case, I think you can still answer the second order question and say, OK, it shows bad judgment. Now there's perjury, whatever. But I think to, in answer to your fundamental question, a long answer to your fundamental question, like insider trading, it is not at all clear to me that this particular chain of information custody should be illegal.
So what this...
don't steal the emails, right? Like the bit at the beginning where the emails were stolen, that should be illegal. But...
So what this does suggest to me, I think it's actually worth connecting this a little bit to Trump's defense, quasi-defense of Saudi Arabia following the Khashoggi killing. And what Trump said was that this killing is terrible. And, you know, of course, we don't condone it. Of course, we condemn it. However, the relationship with Saudi Arabia is important, basically said, because Saudi Arabia buys a lot of our military stuff. And because there's a lot of jobs tied up in that. And so it strikes me that it is at least a possibility. I definitely don't want to go any further than that. But it is at least a possibility that Trump's often weirdly deferential attitude toward Russia is related to the fact that he personally has at least the potential for a bunch of money and deals tied up in that. And he just
is
likes...
Is it, though, or does he just like strong men? Does
he just, also just like strong men. I mean, these are
truly
related.
Truly, like, I think it's the answer to that question matters a lot, and we can't know it.
Yeah.
But Trump Jr. has said they have a bunch of money tied up in Russia. And what we know about Trump is that when he has basically, let's call him a business partner, a potential trading partner, he doesn't like to go after those folks too hard, as long as they're
till after
money.
The deal is done.
I'm not,
right?
I'm not sure that's true, Peter. I mean, Trump.
But that's not that he coordinated with the hackers, right? That's a different story.
Right.
That's
but
just sort of
on your claim.
On your claim,
Trump has the Trump Organization has way more dealings in China, for example, on the ground. Tons of stuff going on in China. His daughter's making stuff. You can't be a manufacturer of any sort without having a ton of deals in China. And what has Trump's relationship with China been? He's imposed tariffs on China. There's an agreement whose details we haven't quite seen yet that was announced out of the G20 meeting that Eric Boehm, is that how you pronounce his name, by the way? Boehm?
Yep. Boehm? You got it.
It's going to be Boehm from now
Boehm.
On.
Nope.
Wrote about on our site this morning, but even that leaves, from what I understand, a 10% broad-based tariff on a lot of goods coming out of China. So that would suggest, at a minimum, that that's not a consistent principle. And I don't necessarily think it's the most...
But Trump has been grumpy about his dealings with China for years, if not decades, in part because he views their currency manipulation and the way they sort of do debt as something that harms him and his business deals.
Maybe. Nick, I wanted to get you the second order question, not the legal hair splitting, crazy libertarian ideas that Catherine and you agree about, but just on a should level, or like how much the should not matters to you. If and this is predicated on the if that might not be true. Let's be totally clear about that. It might not be true that there's any coordination of any significant ways, just a bunch of coincidences between people who are Trump friendly and Russia about the procurement and distribution of the DNC and Hillary Clinton emails. That
right.
But if that happened, if they lied about it, how much does that lying, how much the activity and the lying matter to you?
So I think, first off, the most important question is, you know, are the emails real? And do they have important information in them? Which I think, you know, nobody claimed they were fake. And they did have significant information that affected Hillary Clinton's campaign, because it turned out that the DNC was running a front organization for the Hillary campaign against Bernie Sanders, which fed into the sense that Hillary was using her privilege and status to kind of screw over Bernie Sanders, and that didn't help her in the general election. It also compounded or underscored the fact that she had private servers where things could go missing in a way that one assumes they were not going to, if she was actually following government protocols on stuff. So I think that to me is like really important, and we've totally forgotten about all of that, because now the question is, how do you use this to kind of get Trump screwed over. If he said, hey, you know, what about all those missing emails? You know, somebody should hack them, Rush. I would love to see what's in them. And then a bunch of hackers do it. I don't think that's a problem for Trump. If he ends up lying, I mean, like, you know, obviously, and this goes to stuff that Ken White has written about us. Of course, you're going to lie when you talk to the FBI, because the way that they phrase everything, they're going to get you for some kind of either misstatement or obstruction of justice, or you know, you also could be a liar. And it's hard to know with somebody like Trump and the people around him, whether he's lying on purpose or he's just talking and is constantly contradicting himself. But I don't think, I think it's bad to have people in government who are habitual liars. Let me put it that way. But by the same token, I think the larger story here is really, what was in the emails, and, you know, were the emails real? And that's, you know, we lose that thread, I think, at the cost of seeing a bigger picture. That's really important, because governments should be, and the people who work in government should be transparent, and they're going to be made transparent whether they want to be or not.
So I referenced earlier Trump and tariffs and China and such. Like, there was news at the end of last month, obviously, that GM is laying off 14,000 people in America, closing 5 plants, including at the historic Poletown site, which was cleared for them using some of the most egregious acts of eminent domain in modern American history. The president reacted to this news with characteristic temperance. He said they better damn well open a new plant there very quickly. You're playing around with the wrong person. This country's done a lot for General Motors. You better get back in there soon. And then my favorite bit, they say that Chevy Cruze is not selling well. I say, well, then get a car that is selling well and put it back in there. They better put something else in. Catherine, just broader, 30,000 foot level. What are some lessons from America's relationships with GM?
I think I actually sent out, since this whole podcast is actually just us recounting things that happened on Reason's Slack, I think I sent out a message at some point at the end of last week just saying, could someone please write a "Why Isn't GM Already Dead?" article? Because, like, the real takeaway is, interventions beget interventions. And here we are 1,000 miles down the road of not only subsidies and special treatment and incentives for lobbying, but then also, you'll recall that there was a whole messy intervention under Obama with the way that bankruptcy payouts occurred in other bailed out firms in the auto industry. I just happened across a piece this morning. Headline on CNN, GM has barely paid federal taxes for years. Here's why. And it's just an absolute garbage fire that is entirely of the federal government's own making, because we fetishize specific industries, including auto manufacturing, including weapons manufacture, including steel, including corn for no darn reason.
Hollywood.
And
house building.
Yeah. And this has to do with an aesthetic self-conception of Americanness that is utterly ungrounded in economic realities. It is deeply frustrating to see Trump, if anything, take that kind of what's that book that people were really into maybe 10, 15 years ago, where you're just
Don't
imagine.
Move my cheese.
No, the one where you just imagine what you want and then you get it. The Secret. Like Trump is just practicing The Secret. He's like, open a plant in Ohio. And like, there's nothing behind that.
Hey, that works.
Yeah.
Suderman.
So just basically, like, we are now so far from anything that looks like normal economic forces acting on GM that we will never know what the appropriate behavior is. But I'm pretty sure that it's not subsidize the wazoo out of it, make it so they don't have to pay any taxes, have them produce a bunch of bad cars under very, very, very specific federal restrictions that have nothing to do with the current provision of fuel or fuel standards, and then be mad when their business doesn't work out.
Suderman, one thing that Nick in particular and I also like to point out is that a lot of the governing pathologies of the Republican Party long predate the rise and presidency of Donald Trump. You have written a lot of interesting words about Paul Ryan and also about Scott Walker. And Paul Ryan, as memory would serve, supported the auto bailouts back in the day. And Scott Walker, who was recently drummed out of office, part of the reason why he was the absolute crony capitalist boondoggle known as Foxconn, which Zach Weissmuller has done some great reporting for us on. So do you have any reflections on pre-Trump era GOP politicians and their relationships to crony capitalism once it happens to their own backyard?
Republicans talk a big game about crony capitalism, particularly after the election of Barack Obama in 2008. I mean, I did a whole article for Newsweek back before the pre-collapse Newsweek, let's call it, about how a sort of small subset of Republicans were taking on crony capitalism. One of them was Paul Ryan, who I interviewed for that piece. And then, of course, Paul Ryan and Scott Walker and President Trump all got together basically to put together this Foxconn deal. And what they seem to it is the definition of crony capitalism. It is them using politics, including subsidies and sweeteners and the threats of eminent domain to get the property secured in order to create jobs, which, as we know in the case of Foxconn, end up not being created, the jobs numbers are much lower than expected. And now Foxconn is actually talking about importing Chinese workers because they can't find Americans to hire at this plant. And so this is, I think, embedded in the Republican Party's DNA, which is that crony capitalism writ large on a national scale is bad when Democrats do it. But local crony capitalism, the kind that benefits specific politicians in specific districts, or that they view as benefiting, in the case of Scott Walker, arguably it did not. Paul Ryan he retired rather than was voted out, but maybe it didn't benefit him either. But when they view it as benefiting them specifically and their constituents specifically, it's totally different and totally okay. And it's really just a very bad way at looking at industrial policy and economic planning, because it's totally about government picking winners and losers. And you see this with Trump, too, with Trump, you know, threatening to GM about the plant closures in Ohio. And that is Trump attempting to use the bully power of the most politically powerful office in the country to threaten GM to not close their plant and to not cut jobs.
Nick, I seem to recall, and correct me where I'm wrong, that you did a recent TV video 3 or 4 years ago along the lines of, here's three reasons why GM didn't really pay back those loans. Can you just explain real quick how right you were?
Well, obviously it's a gift that keeps on giving, right? So GM, as Catherine was talking about, you know, intervention breeds intervention breeds intervention. So, you know, it's a shame that we didn't have the courage to let major industries that are clearly dying go out of business and figure out what comes next rather than trying to prop up stuff. GM, shortly before it was bailed out, had sold a record number of cars and had posted massive losses because it's an unsustainable company, or it was. And it would have been great to see that. I was also reminded, as Peter was talking, it's obviously, you know, Democrats do this as well, but politicians, we interviewed David Stockman, who's best remembered now as Reagan's budget director, who tried to cut spending a lot. And the minute that he started going after defense budgets in the Reagan White House, he basically got put on ice. But he was a congressman from Michigan, and he was not from an auto plant district originally, but he was from a district where there were a lot of car part manufacturers. And he opposed, when he was either a freshman or in his second term as a congressman, he opposed a bailout for Chrysler, like a loan guarantee. That was a big deal at the time. And he told us, you know, that he went to his constituents and he said, I'm against this because this is not the right way to, you know, that politics should be done. Capitalism shouldn't be done this way. And he was returned with, you know, a larger percentage of the vote. So it's not even that you have to do this kind of stuff politically in order to survive. It's that there is an entire argument, which I think is the correct argument, which is that the government shouldn't pick winners and losers, and that the economy works best when government, you know, kind of English put on the cue ball is at a minimum. Like, that argument has really kind of disappeared really quickly. Because, you know, Matt, I think you were the one who wrote about how when George Bush said that in order to save free market capitalism, I'm essentially ending it, that I don't think any of us really thought that he was nailing that window shut. It was just that this was, you know, there was like a big crisis going on. People were freaking out and it would reassert itself. The idea that a minimally regulated economy is better, you know, than a maximally one. And like it's kind of shocking to see how far the Republican Party has gone away from that message.
My favorite little B-plot in this is that one of the plants Jim is closing is in Canada. And the business columnist for the Toronto Star wrote a column titled, "It's Time for a Truly Canadian Automaker," suggesting that Canada nationalize the GM plant and turn it into the Canada car.
Yeah. You go.
Dude, the
part
Canada
two.
Car. The Canada car
is my label, to be clear.
Yeah.
Not his.
But. No, but it's so easy to imagine the Canada car. Like, it's just, I look forward
it
to
would
it.
Smell
I
like
look forward
maple
to its
all
failure.
The time.
They
yeah.
should make it in Ottawa because I just learned on Twitter, so it must be true, that Ottawa has become one of the largest cities in the world to eradicate rats. So hats off.
Was that Alberta?
Whatever.
Okay, I'm moving there immediately.
Ottawa's it's in, not definitely not all the same. They should rename Ottawa like A-U-T-O.
Oh my
they
God.
They should rename it No Rattawa.
Nope.
Oh,
that's,
what?
It's Alberta
no,
that they
I
don't
mean,
have rats.
We had a perfectly good
well, whichever
solution.
One it is then.
Before we get into our end of podcast, what are you consuming bits? Here I want to point out, especially to listeners, in the New York area, since you're the ones who can actually follow through on this, there is a Soho Forum event tonight in New York City. Reason co-sponsors it. It's a debate. Should the government get rid of cash and restrict cryptocurrencies? It takes place at the Subculture Theater, and it's between Harvard's Ken Rogoff and George Mason University's Larry White. Go out to reason.com website for more information about that, which we'll also include in the post for this podcast. That was good, right? Also, before we get into what we all have been recently consuming in the culture, there is a end-of-year wrap-up that was posted on the site just this morning that Jesse Walker collected from staff picks, their favorite shiz in 2018. That's dad vocabulary, Catherine, from 2018. So go give that a look. And with that throat clear, Nick, what have you been consuming of particular interest to your brain tubes?
I started watching Homecoming, the Julia Roberts Amazon streaming series, which is pretty good.
You okay, buddy?
Yeah.
That big at the beginning makes me think that maybe
was,
you weren't actually watching it.
I actually spent, I started watching it about four episodes in and I'm going to finish it, but I spent most of the weekend watching college football. And I feel bad talking about sports on this podcast for some reason.
Podcast. Yeah. Peter.
This was the, you know, it was the championship weekend for different conferences. So there was a lot of good stuff going on.
Catherine, what sports did you watch this weekend?
Funny man. I watched no sports. Instead, I did my favorite sport, which was throwing things away out of my house. So I was doing some cleaning and I came across a book that was my favorite book for many, many years. Mortals by Norman Rush, which I like pulled out of the stack of books to discard and started rereading. It's really, really good, dudes. It's set in Botswana. It's extremely hashtag problematic now in ways that are fascinating because it did not feel hashtag problematic in a Me Too-ish kind of way when I read it initially, 8, 9, 10 years ago. It's a bunch of American expats in Botswana in various politically inflected love triangles. And I really, really recommend it.
Suderman?
I bought a copy of Nina Simone's Baltimore on vinyl, and it is just amazing how great this old copy of this record sounds. And it I can't even sort of describe how wonderful kind of a physical aesthetic aural experience it is to hear it, to hear for music that's older than I am reproduced so well.
And I, this weekend, again, because hashtag dad, had to take a bunch of terrible tween girls to go see Wreck-It Ralph 2, which the country has been seeing, so I'm not adding a whole lot here, but I would just like
which
to
has
give
gotten
a shout
some
out,
very good reviews.
Because when I had heard about this movie and the fact that they had basically every single tie-in to every property that's owned by Disney, I aggressively rolled my eyes and talked smack about it in front of my 10-year-old daughter, saying that's about the cheapest and laziest type of cross-promotion hashtag content. And with that bad attitude going in, the Disney princess scene of that movie. It was about my favorite scene in any movie I've seen in a year or so. It's just really clever and funny. And then the song montage going into, still laughing about it, going into the terrible Peter Suderman like car smash him up video game. Just hilarious, wonderful movie making. So thank you for proving me wrong. It's always helpful. Before we leave this, I would like to remind all listeners, we're still doing our webathon. It's the last couple of days here. So if you value this podcast, in addition to subscribing to it on Apple Podcasts and on Spotify, please do go look at reason.com/webathon for all of our various giving levels, which include very small, teeny little Ottawa rat style gifts, but also larger ones too. It supports our journalism and commentary and life in ways that really make a reason resilience and possible. So thank you for those who have already done that. And for those who are still wobbling, stop the wobbles, go in there, get her done. And we appreciate all of that. And so that is it. Thank you for listening. And see you again on this podcast next week and throughout the week on other recent podcasts. Goodbye.
Hey, it's Nick Gillespie again. Thanks for listening. If you liked the podcast, if you liked what you heard, if you like what you read in our print magazine and on our website, if you like watching our videos, if you like seeing our staff people on all sorts of cable news and or hearing them on radio programs and podcasts, please consider giving us a tax-deductible charitable donation during our webathon. Go to reason.com for details. You'll see what kind of swag comes with what kind of gift level. It's all pretty good stuff, and it really makes the difference. Free minds and free markets aren't free, and we really rely on your help to keep us going.